From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. The origins of the constitutional government we enjoy today come from classical liberal ideas about individual rights, the consent of the governed, private property. Most point to John Locke, Thomas Paine, and of course Thomas Jefferson as the sources of those concepts. But is that totally accurate? And from where did they get those ideas? We tend to think of the Puritans as inflexible and reactionary, but author and essayist Marilynne Robinson says, hold on. When it comes to our political concepts, we may owe them and religion a lot more than we think. She just wrote One Manner of Law, The Religious Origins of American Liberalism for Harper's Magazine. She joins us this hour. Marilynne, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
So, you know, we do tend to love to point to Thomas Jefferson in our study of the ideas that form classical American liberalism. You took a look at that and you said, well, maybe you want to look at something else. You want to go on a little earlier, maybe to England's Puritan Revolution. You say perhaps we should start there?
That's an interesting question. The Puritan Revolution in England never really seems to have gelled to the point of, you know, like producing a meaningful constitution, for example. I mean, literally that. Cromwell wrote one, but it's a very minimal thing. The people in New England were in the position of actually sort of creating a society in line with what were Puritan ideas, but they were active in a period when Cromwell was active in England, which means that there was no royal authority. And they were actually thinking about creating society, you know, from its own materials, from the human accommodations that are made without that kind of punitive energy that has existed in so, you know, so characteristically exists in human cultures. I think of these, and I think it's proper to think of them as, in a certain sense, really American ideas. They came up out of the experience of English people, of course, but living on an American landscape and generating a mode of coexistence among themselves that was unique to that situation.
So, you know, if you look at the earlier era, the sermons, the pamphlets that are going around, there are dissenters, there are nonconformists. And they're really talking about, and they're talking to a people who are increasingly literate. And I'm talking about pre-revolutionary London and periods like that. So there is this discussion that's going on, correct?
Yes, it's true. I think, though, that you can tell by reading the Body of Liberties that they have drawn from their own experience, you know. I mean, the idea of we will determine how property will be distributed, you know, I mean, in the sense that we will allow you to inherit or to pass on property, even if you are excommunicated or otherwise condemned and so on. These attempts to give people a degree of mobility and a degree of control over their own assets that I think would be very hard for anyone to approximate in the existing culture of England at that time, even, you know, revolutionary as it was relative to what came before.
You know, among those who were dissenting in England at that time were the Puritans, and many of them, in point of fact, dissented so much that they left New England, or they left England rather. And they bring with them some of these ideas about taking a look at what should be a proper form of government, and whether, for example, monarchy, as they knew it in England, is a legitimate form of government.
Right. And that came up as a very pointed issue, because there were places like the Low Countries and Geneva that were very close culturally to the English in that period, the Puritans in that period, who had gotten rid of hereditary rulers then, were republics. So the possibility of reorganizing in that radical way, you know, was certainly available to them by example.
You know, if there's one Puritan who I think most Americans are familiar with, that has to be John Winthrop, who we know from his speech, Model of Christian Charity, speaking to people mm-hmm. as they're headed to Massachusetts and saying, you know, we must consider that we're going to build this city upon a hill. But don't we tend to make the mistake of thinking that he's talking about a shining city that's a financial juggernaut? And he's not really saying that. He's talking about something else.
Absolutely. People forget that it is a model of Christian charity that he's talking about. And what he's talking about is the way that a society can be, you know, can live with itself in a way that, you know, that enacts Christian values in the sense of looking after those who are poor and so on, which is a circumstance for the Puritans and not a class, which is a very important difference. Because under British law into the 20th century, the laws are different depending on whether you fall into the category they call the poor or the laborers or the working class. This goes clear back to the 14th century. So, you know, Winthrop says the reason that there are rich and poor is because God would take more satisfaction from seeing us respond generously to the fact than if he were to do it himself, you know, which means that the difference of rich and poor in the context as he understands it is an obligation to mutual care, mutual generosity, you know. This is very, very remote from what had been the prevailing view in the culture that they came from.
So how did we in this day and age, many of us make that mistake of thinking that he's talking about wealth and power and finance sometimes? Is that something that comes from, say, Max Weber or someone like that?
Certainly Max Weber was a great contributor to that mistake, no question about it. But then there's a kind of rhetorical tradition of acting as if the New World existed only to generate wealth, you know? And that comes very logically out of the colonial system that, you know, that produced tobacco and cotton and so on in the southern colonies. But the literature of thought, you know, the aspirational literature comes from New England, which was blessed with stony soil and bad winters and was not appropriate as a plantation culture.
You know, when we study early American history, we tend to steer clear of the Puritans. But that's a mistake, you're saying.
A huge mistake. And, you know, they're a stigmatized group on the basis of nothing except that we know that they should be a stigmatized group, you know. The influence that they had over the whole country and over the whole world, so profound. I mean, things like, you know, the descendants, you know, the people in the 1830s and 1840s and so on, were the great builders of universities, the great mm-hmm. public school people, you know, continuously trying to raise levels of literacy, which they did very impressively. You know, people from New England founded the University of Hawaii, the University of Colorado, you know, the huge value that they put on education and literacy was something that was an influence of theirs that was asserted right across the continent, quite amazingly.
Yeah, they really do put a high value on education, which we seem to have forgotten about. Because they wanted their children to be able to read the Bible for themselves?
That's true. It's also true that if you look at the kinds of universities or colleges, I should say, that they created, very often, I would say typically, characteristically, they had to be educated in the humanities before they were educated in theology. So, you know, these people were very civilized, you know, and their model is, of course, Oxford and Cambridge, you know, where many of the first people came from. But the idea of and humane studies and so on was characteristic of the kind of educational culture they, you know, it wasn't simply, you know, vocational in a sense, no matter how high the vocation.
You know, one of the folks who comes over is a man named Hugh Peter, and he's a preacher, but he's not just another preacher. This is someone who in his life is going to wield considerable influence on both sides of the Atlantic. He writes this very popular pamphlet, Good Work for a Good Magistrate, or A Shortcut to Great Quiet, by honest, homely, plain English hints given from scripture, reason, and experience for the regulating of most cases in this commonwealth concerning religion, mercy, and justice. Now, the ideas that he expresses in this, they don't sound anything like the Puritans that we think we know.
Yes, I think that's true, because we really don't know them. You know, there's a way in which they have become a sort of historical enclave. We could read, you know, what John Owen has to say about, you know, generosity and so on. We don't. We simply, since that word has such power to ridicule and stigmatize, we don't bother to look at the absolutely enormous literature that they produced, you know, much of which is very, very large-spirited.
You know, Peter turned his, when you read this and you look at his ideas, he turns his back on traditional ideas of government and president. And he is really talking about really a new method of governing that seems much more tolerant of other denominations. It's society moving in a different direction, and maybe away from this divine right of kings.
Oh, absolutely. He was, as Puritans were in general, he was a great believer in individual conscience. Mm-hmm. And if you read their descriptions of what the conscience is, it's basically the meeting place between God and the self. You know, it's utterly sacred. And this is, of course, not capable of being relatively more or less true. You know, I mean, the sort of idea of the essential divinity of a human being is very much invested in the, you know, the sacredness of conscience. And on the basis of that, you know, religious tolerance is such a bad word, you know, because, of course, it implies that we're enduring each other in some way, when in fact what he's saying is that the conscience is the most beautiful thing, and it has to be celebrated in the fact that it is free and determining for people who are attentive to it.
You know, he's championing a really just social order in which the judiciary, for example, they're made up of people who are going to have to stand for election and do that on a regular basis.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, people talk about they're being influenced by Mosaic law, and I think in a way that might be true, because the origin, I mean, in that specific, it's true in many ways, but, you know, if you read the books of Moses, the first way that they try to order their civilization is by making judges, you know, having judges that can establish justice. And that seems to be an idea that was adopted, because it's available to election, and it's also non-hierarchical, essentially.
Now, Hugh Peter, he writes this pamphlet that we talked about earlier, but he uses scripture as his justification for the reforms that he's talking about. This is not political philosophy that he is talking about. This is biblical, correct?
Yes. I mean, it seems to me as if the political philosophy that he and the early Americans were talking about, the Yankees were talking about, is an ethic of mutual love, like as in Winthrop's address, you know, that any theory of civilization had to arise first, that you owe people, you know, a merciful heart, you know, mm-hmm. that you owe people attentiveness to the cruelties that, you know, that collective behavior can produce and so on, you know. I mean, I think it's deeper than political theory, but it functions beautifully as political theory.
Peter writes, it's a quote from, "Let no difference be made between Jews or Gentiles, bond or free, stranger or natives, in either criminal or civil things. For so hath God commanded, and by this means shall the governors be true fathers of humanity. That doesn't sound like there's much separation there between church and state, for example. Is that a fair reading of that?
Well, it's a kind of, this is true and not true. You know, I mean, there is, obviously, if he's talking about being completely fair to Jews and Muslims and whoever else might be in this list, he is talking about a separation of church and state, because in England, you know, in England, you had to satisfy certain standards of Orthodox Christianity in order to have civil rights. You know, that's kind of where the Puritans were in Massachusetts. So there is a separation of church and state in the sense that every person was to be treated equally under all circumstances without regard to religion. On the other hand, he is appealing to a religious standard, which is that one ought to wish to be the father of the people that fall under your authority, you know. But that is an invoking a value. It's not imposing what would be a social practice, you know. I mean, obviously, what he says about non-Christian people, that they ought to have absolutely the same justice that anyone else would have, that's something that would work out as politics. It would work out in day-to-day life. That a magistrate might wish to be the father of his people is something that he would aspire to privately, no doubt, or that he would feel persuaded to embrace because he associates himself with the religion that encourages it.
Yeah, I mean, the Puritans really are non-conformists. I mean, they literally left England because of concerns about having to conform to the Anglican Church. So this is in a lot of respects a restating of that idea about religion and conforming and society and that sort of thing, right?
Yes, I mean, I think in a way Hugh Peters is more interesting than my colonial Puritans, because he's trying to deal with an incredibly complex proto-modern society, you know, in England. And the fact that the stresses, the terrible stresses, the warfare that came out of all these differences might be expected to, you know, to cloud his thinking. But he never says that certain people ought to be, you know, viewed as outside the realm of justice or, you know, equality. Even despite the fact that, you know, the horrendous things and complicated things were happening around him in England.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to be saying, look, we don't want religious persecution, which is the reason we had to leave where we were. But we do not want here religious persecution, right?
Yes, that's true. But it is also true that he is quite closely paraphrasing a law of Moses. It's God that says everyone should have equal access to justice and so on. On one hand, he's relaxing religious distinctions completely. On the other hand, he's using it on the authority of Moses. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, who is he writing this pamphlet to? Is to other ministers? Is he writing it to folks back in England, to the general public? These ideas that he's expressing, who does he want to hear them?
Well, he's in England while he's writing that pamphlet. You know, he lived in England he was briefly in America, 6 years, I think, and then finished his life in England, but in about the span of life of the Cromwell Revolution, actually. But he was a famous preacher. He was famous for humor. A lot of people hated him because he, you know, made jokes while he was preaching and so on. But he had a following among common people, but he was also chaplain to Parliament as well as Cromwell. And so he could have been writing to anyone across the whole field of either literary you know, literate British people or people that would have access to somebody who would read the pamphlet to them, you know. He could have had a very, very widespread audience.
So in 1641, Massachusetts comes up with what's called the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, which really becomes the longtime foundation for a legal system there. Again, it's 1641, but there's a lot that we're going to see in this that we would see later. Due process, right to a hearing, freedom of speech. These are ideas that we have even today.
Absolutely. And, you know, these ideas are clearly foundational, even though people forgot that they had been articulated in 1641, you know, which is really, I mean, it shows how deeply they go into the culture as ideas. But one of the things that has been a concern for me is that I read about like legal decisions being based on precedent that's found in, you know, legal history. But this very most important stream of legal history is not acknowledged. So when they go delving back, they're looking at laws that were written in London as a system of exploitation for colonies in the South. They should go back to the laws that were made in America for American circumstances by people who identified with America, you know, and who came up with values and statements that are so profound that you really do feel that you're reading a modern document when you read much of what they wrote.
The Massachusetts Body of Liberties, it really doesn't sound like traditional English liberty. For example, before and after 1641, there were some other approaches that people talked about that were put forward in England. There's one thing you talk about called Dale's Codes, and that does not sound like something we would want to have here. Maybe you could explain Dale's Codes and what that entailed to us, for us.
Dale was the first governor of the colony of Virginia, and it's very interesting to read, you know, the liberties in the context of other law that was being written to govern the same sort of situation at the same time. The Dale's Laws were written in England to be applied in Virginia. And you can tell from them that you know, it might as well have been a forced labor camp. Hideous, hideous laws, you know. And you know, I mean, I've read a good deal now of early colonial law not outside New England. And the idea that there was any sort of rights of Englishmen or any of these things that people talk about, any observation of anything that could be called common law, the laws are simply brutal and punitive. Over against them, you know, over against the incredible coercive impulse behind the people who were the backers of colonialism in England, you have this enormously generous and charitable legal system arising out of the idea that law should establish people's freedom rather than establishing the constraints within which they were forced to live.
Yeah, I mean, Dale's Codes says things like death for missing church three times, death for speaking ill of the king, no rights protected anyone to whom the laws apply, no mention of trial or appeal, as opposed to what we're talking about, what seemed to be with the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, the earliest protections of individual rights in America.
Without question, hands down.
Is it not fair to say that surely Thomas Jefferson later would have read this or heard some of these ideas from this?
I really think he must have. You know, I remember reading, I think it was in his notes on Virginia, but I'm not sure. But he himself, with a friend of his, I think, they were putting together a system of laws for Virginia. And then he's very honestly and with embarrassment says they were brutal, awful laws, and we realized that everything was tending in another way, you know, and abandon them. But that seems to me as if it indicates that there is a point of awareness for Jefferson where he was introduced into another conception of what a constitution or what a state could look like.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. You know, the body of liberties, it really does look like a constitution. It defines the relationship of an individual to the state, talks about sources of authority coming from ratification by the colonial assembly, and not so much not a king. So this really does seem to see a new approach to what it is that we're trying to come bring forward with regard to the new world.
Yes, one of the things that interests me is that the Declaration of Independence looks a lot like the transcript of the trial of Charles I. When you think about it, you know, Jefferson or who they together, they listed the offenses against the king, you know, an indictment against the king, which is an argument against one particular king, as in the case of Charles I, you know, but it's not an argument against monarchy. And I think it's, even though they were anti-monarchical, I think that this memory of that trial, which they must all have read, you know, all those young lawyers, the memory of it preserved something that simulates it without necessarily being entirely relevant to what they were doing, you know?
You know, Hugh Peter, he did not write the Massachusetts Body of Liberties. I believe that was Nathaniel Ward, you'd say, who wrote that. And he, who was a Puritan preacher. But isn't it fair to say that the ideas of Peter's influenced Ward's words and what he came up with?
Yes, they passed those laws around and people amended them, you know, and passed them back and forth and so on. And sort of like what you read about people passing a bill in Congress now, you know, to the extent they do that. But in any case, you know, there is a detail in the laws that makes me think of Hugh Peters, which is perhaps shipwreck. He says people, if they're shipwrecked, their goods will be saved. They will be taken care of, you know, the survivors and so on. And he came from Cornwall, and the major industry of Cornwall was basically looting shipwrecks, you know? And, you know, but in any case, I think he's one of the people under whose hand the laws passed. And Nathaniel Ward, I think, basically puts he was kind of like Jefferson. He put the ideas into, you know, elegant form.
So can we call this then the Puritan vision for the New World? This body of liberties is that a consensus, Puritan consensus for the New World?
Yes, I think that that's true. The of course there were Puritans in other places in Massachusetts, of course, like in Virginia and so on, who might have had a different take on things. But the thing that I think is that makes this a stable, permanent Puritan vision is the many allusions to the laws of Moses. That's another one of the odd things about the way history is dealt with. Moses does not allow capital punishment for crimes against property, you know? Mm-hmm. And all these people, you know, tens of thousands of people in England and Europe were executed for stealing, you know, the proverbial loaf of bread, you know, a shilling, something like that. So at that level of just sort of basic respect for a human being, that some sense of the proportion of value between a human being and a shilling or a sheep. Moses is vastly more generous than any of the laws that followed him in Europe. And this kind of thing is characteristically true. Moses is an enlightened figure. relative to anything that happened in Europe in the pre-modern period. And he has been, in a way, made stigmatized in the same way that the Puritans are. People don't look at him and actually see what he instructed us to do.
It's hard really to believe that this pamphlet, these ideas, come from someone that Cromwell and Parliament later is going to list as a chaplain.
It tells you a lot. I mean, while we're talking about stigmatized figures, it's hard to come up with a better example than Oliver Cromwell, you know. But it does give you an insight into his worldview that this was his chaplain, you know. I mean, chaplains were no doubt not hard to find in those days, and Hugh Peters was his chaplain.
You know, the Massachusetts Body of Liberties, it does also include some protections against the abuse of animals, but it's the first document formulated in North America that sanctions slavery, though, isn't it?
It's the first document that perhaps specifically acknowledged slavery. Because slavery was so utterly commonplace, you know, it was completely a feature of colonialism, because labor was necessary to make the colonies prosper. And of course, if you don't pay your help, you prosper a lot more. But in any case, the law concerning slavery there is also from the Old Testament. Yeah. And it has the same, it doesn't talk about hereditary slavery, it talks about slavery that is occasional in the sense that you are captive in a war or something like that, which is all Old Testament. It's interesting, if you read the amendment, or if you read the charge, rather, that Jefferson wanted to put in the Declaration of Independence, and it was voted out, about African slavery, he says, he accuses the king of making an unjust war against an unoffending people. And in other words, he thinks it shows the power of even that idea, you know, that you can only enslave people who are captives of a just war. And the invasion, the stripping out of the population of Africa was a war, according to Jefferson, quite appropriately, against an unoffending people. So, you know, there's nothing, it's not as if the law says slavery is okay. Mm-hmm. It's as if can be practiced under certain circumstances, which are rare, it can't be assumed as being something that's a racial or hereditary privilege or anything like that, as opposed to John Locke, who, of course, is absolute.
Yeah, in fact, Locke, if I seem to recall correctly, had come up with some ideas about the governing of Virginia that would have kept in place ideas that seemed more like feudalism than democracy.
Yes. The introduction to those laws specifically says that the purpose is to prevent the development of a democracy. The laws were written after the Cromwell Revolution, of course, written in England, you know. And what they're doing is revising a vision of society that would be immune to, you know, to what had happened in England, the democratic impulses that had asserted themselves there. In any case, when you compare Locke's laws with the liberties, the use of property in feudalism, you know, was profoundly important. Even, you know, the more property you had, basically, the more elevated your status was, and the more legal power you had over other people, and so on. I mean, this was based on primogeniture, and it was based on the idea that certain lands, you know, estates could not be alienated, which meant there would be one heir and then everyone else more or less impoverished, you know. When you read the laws in the liberties in with reference to the laws that Locke is basically reproducing in the New World, you know, you can see the incredible importance of being able to tell people that their land is their own, And they can leave it to their children, even if they are in trouble with the church, or, you know, they can sell it and move to another place. And again, you know, the laboring classes in England had pass laws. And again, you see this reflected in Locke's constitution. They could not leave the estate that they, you know, were born in without a slip saying where they were going and that they had permission, how long they would be gone, and so on. And this continued into the 20th century, with the result that a lot of people left the land and went to the cities and were basically sort of illegal aliens within those cities. They had very few rights because they weren't, you know, they weren't born there. The rights that they had, even in theory, were in their place of their birth, you know. So the idea that you actually own your own property and it can and can alienate it if you choose to, and that you can come and go as you choose, these are both radical reforms of English practice.
So the Puritans, who really are concerned about people being forced to conform, there were times when they did crack down on dissent. I'm talking about, for example, their treatment of the religious leader Anne Hutchinson. Her methods and ideas, they did clash with John Winthrop. She ended up being excommunicated and banished.
Yes, well, they had, you know, they were...
They're not perfect.
I mean, they're not perfect. And Anne Hutchinson, of course, they were quite amazingly circumspect in the way that they went about banishing her, you know. I mean, she didn't have to leave while the weather was bad, and she could have guests at her house, you know, sort of thing, you know. I mean, by the standards of similar transgressions in an English or a Southern situation, their laws were lenient, you know. Not that this is, of course, ever desirable, but, you know, they were human, and they were human in a particular context of historical habits and so on, which, you know, they relapsed from time to time.
Was there concern that she was speaking from within the denomination and speaking some different ideas from within the denomination, as opposed to being an outsider coming with from a different tradition? Was that the difference? Part of the difference?
Yeah, I can. I suppose it would be. I'm not as knowledgeable about Anne Hutchinson as I should be. But I think that one of the things that was a complexity for these people is that they felt that their religious culture was the prop that allowed them to have their political culture, you know. And their religious culture is very democratic, you know. They voted a minister in, they voted him out if they wanted to. They could always form another church if they wanted to, you know. They conferred with each other, but they couldn't govern each other, you know. And so that their religious culture, which was very exceptional in the world at the time, was a sort of model. They even wrote about that congregationalism as being the model for democracy. And so it's as if they lost that, then they might lose the whole system of democracy that, you know, that they were tending toward.
There was also this dispute with Roger Williams, who ends up going to what would be Rhode Island. Similar concerns about his views conflicting with the general views within the community.
Yeah, and I don't know how deep that goes. I'm sort of aware of the fact that Rhode Island was more involved in the slave trade than any other part, than any other place in New England. It was deeply involved. I went to Brown, so I'm sort of aware of that. and, you know, there might have been, we always make these very simple oppositions of who thought what and who did not tolerate. But in fact, there might be ideas that are actually better or worse, you know, that, you know, some of the implications perhaps of Roger Williams' thought led in directions that people in Massachusetts might not wholly approve.
Hugh Peter, in this time period that we're talking about, he has yet to return to England to participate in this, in what's going to be a struggle against and an execution of King Charles. But clearly, Hugh Peter and others in New England, they've been sharing these ideas about how they should live. And he sees this opportunity in Massachusetts Bay Colony for want of a better concept, truly a different world from what they've had in the past.
That's true. Although, you know, they talked about like the two Englands and so on. Hugh Peters believed that the American model would be profoundly important in the reconstruction of an English society. And so he felt the ideas that they had arrived at in Massachusetts could travel, clearly could be reasserted in other places. Although, you know, the New Englanders, of course, had special circumstances like limitless land
mm-hmm.
and the fact that they had gone through an excruciating period of starvation and sickness together and so on, you know.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. You know, when he goes back, the monarchists, they don't have too much love for Hugh Peter. After Cromwell dies, Hugh Peter underwent a pretty painful death.
That's just terrible. I mean, really, you can't even repeat it, you know. It was, on the one hand, it was an incredible, you know, bout of rage against Cromwell and all the rest. On the other hand, they did that to Jesuits, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. that was, I think, particularly contrived for them, partly because Jesuits were assumed to be traitors, you know, because of the Spanish,
yes,
you know, conflict. But they, you know, if you read these old laws and the readiness with which people cut off each other's ears and split each other's noses and put heads on pikes and hung, I mean, they very frequently dismembered people and put like a leg in the one place, one part of the country, and an arm in another, and so on. It was a reign of terror, basically. It was just so established that people didn't use that language for it. Utter disrespect for human bodies is just the problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, half hanging and dismemberment. It's just amazing. So King Charles II now, he tosses out this body of liberties, but they never forgot about them.
No, I think they had the habit of being a subversive group within society, you know. I mean, they had their printing presses and they had their, you know, meetings in the woods and all the rest of it. They'd done that forever in England and they could just continue with it, you know. You know, a very strong culture actually throve under terrible oppression.
In general, should our religious ideas get more credit for our thoughts on rights and restraints than the credit they've been given already?
Well, I think that in the most brilliant parts of our tradition, that's certainly true. And I think the reason it's true is because of the sanctity of the human individual that is an aspect, you know, of that, what I would call Judeo-Christian culture, but other people seem to find other things in that book. I think that if we remember that the creation is sacred and that human beings are most sacred of all, we can start building a good society, and freedom of conscience and so on will make good kinds of sense to us. I think that if religion simply becomes the sort of clan that you happen to belong to, then it doesn't really have much to offer.
So what's next for you?
Next, you know, I'm thinking about a novel, actually.
Really?
And it will not totally surprise you that I'm working on a book about the Old Testament.
No, you do like to take a look at the the relationship between religion and civil authorities.
Yes, I do. I think that, like, with, you know, to look at our Puritans again, I think that so long as people had an idea that, you know, yes, I'm the judge in this case, but I understand that the man confronting me is as precious to God as I am, you know, that I cannot injure him or insult him without a transgression against God and the fact of doing that. I think you have the basis for a good society.
Marilynne Robinson's books and essays have won widespread praise and countless awards over the years. We've been talking about a piece she authored for Harper's entitled One Manner of Law with the Religious Origins of American Liberalism. Marilynne, thanks very much for the history lesson. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Excellent interview.
Thank you. Hey, you can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.